Welcome to the Functional Breeding Podcast. I'm Jessica Perry-Heckman, and I'm here interviewing people about how to breed dogs for function and for health, behavioral and physical. This podcast is brought to you by the Functional Dog Collaborative, an organization founded to support the ethical breeding of healthy, behaviorally sound dogs. The FDC's goals include providing educational, social, and technical resources to breeders of both purebred and mixed breed dogs. You can find out more at functionalbreeding.org or at the Functional Breeding Facebook group, which we work hard to keep friendly and inclusive. I hope you have fun and learn something. Heads up for podcast listeners. My friend and fellow podcaster, Sarah Strumming, CDBC, is running a small group coaching session for people with brand new puppies who want to get their first few months right. It's not a typical sports puppy program, though most folks joining will at least have a sports light future in mind. With a focus on bravery, positive exposure, and life skills, this program will offer Sarah's support in real time as you raise your puppy. Apply by emailing her about yourself and your puppy at sarah@sarahstrumming.com. That's Sarah with an H. Hi, friends. This week, I'm talking with Dr. Micah Halpern, a geneticist who has worked with many species, including zoo animal population health, and is currently the principal scientist and owner of GenSol Diagnostics. Micah and I got nerdy about genetic testing for canine health and other traits. What are some of the different technologies involved, and how do we think about what accurate means in terms of genetic testing results? On a personal note, I've had a long break from recording podcast episodes, and I'm coming back gradually at this point. My series of unfortunate injuries, including a concussion, a shattered ankle, and two knee replacements, seem to be coalescing into chronic pain that makes working difficult. The Functional Dog Collaborative is a high priority for me, but sometimes I do have to take a break from this podcast while I recover a bit, and this was one of those times. I hope to have episodes coming out more regularly, but also probably a bit more slowly than previously for a while I improve and ramp them back up. I appreciate your patience. Dr. Halpern, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I will start out with a question I always start with everybody, which is tell us about the animals that you live with. Those can include human animals if you want.
Interesting way to phrase that.
Humans are animals.
They are. Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And, you know, it's a pleasure to be here. If we start with the human animals, I have a wife and a daughter. So those would be the human animals. But we have three dogs that live inside with us in the house. And we've got two outdoor dogs that are livestock guardian dogs. Because we also, my wife raises dairy goats. And then we also have horses. And we also have cats, too. So we have quite a little hobby farm going. So lots of animals running around.
Very furry property.
Yes, yes. Very furry, but everybody gets along, and it's a wonderful place.
That's nice.
Yeah.
It's important. It's tough when they don't, for sure. So you have a doctorate in, remind me what it's actually in, where you got it, and...
Yeah, sure. I've got a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University of Central Florida. Before that, I got a master's in forensic DNA analysis, also out of the University of Central Florida. And I started off with a bachelor's in biology with kind of a focus on marine biology. It was actually the first thing I wanted to do a long time ago until I realized it's very difficult to get a job in marine biology. lucky turn of events, you know, early on in my career, I got exposed to sort of how to, you know, use DNA to look at all kinds of questions. And in the beginning, I worked more on sort of ecological based questions like conservation genetics and then moved into doing more diagnostics for things like infectious disease and got into human forensics for a while. And, you know, obviously eventually ended up doing animal diagnostic testing as we're doing now. So, but kind of the theme throughout my whole career is just has been using DNA to essentially get information, you know, on what's going on.
Not that this podcast is about that, but DNA forensics sounds so interesting. Did you get that master's before you went on to get the PhD, or did you like?
Yes. Yeah. It was, and the place I was working for at the time just offered, to pay for it. So I said, well, might as well. I actually ended up getting a grant from the National Institute of Justice to essentially do most of my master's research. Pulled a couple people together and created a, good enough proposal that they funded it, and that's pretty much how I ended up getting my master's.
That's very cool. I've had an interest in animal forensics for a while. I never ended up digging into that too deeply, but it's forensics is
I
very
looked at that as a
interesting.
job too.
Yes, it is. I actually just had lunch with my friend yesterday who runs a animal forensics company.
Oh, neat. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
it's a huge
what's.
company. It's just her.
Yeah, that's usually how it works in this
Right.
that type of industry. And back when I was looking, I think there's I don't know if it's changed, but there was one I think it was a national lab. I think it was out in Oregon or something, but there's basically was one place to do that type of work. So that also sort of fell by the wayside.
There's a couple places now, but not so many.
Good. Good. It's expanded. That's good. Well, and it's grown too, so that's good.
But your conservation work actually might be relevant because there's a lot of times that people ask questions about whether the work that people do in conservation around endangered species is relevant to the work around preserving dog breeds, which to my mind is a bit of a different thing because with species, the whole definition is that it's either impossible or very difficult to breed it to another species. With breeds, that's not the case. But what kind of stuff did you do there?
It was a number of different things. Our overall, what we were looking at was essentially you've got captive animals, that can have a number of different issues from inbreeding to crossbreeding between species that are geographically separated. So they don't create offspring because they can't get together, but put them together in a zoo and they're more than happy to create offspring. So some of the things we looked at was getting at the question of how well is endangered species management working. I specifically was hired for a project on penguins, looking at penguins off pretty much the coast of South America, off the coast of Africa, and sort of looking at what kind of we use coefficient of inbreeding, which is starting to become in vogue for dog breeding. That's been used more recently, but back then we were looking at how did the diversity of those wild populations look compared to captive populations. So basically getting at the question of are zoos inbreeding, these animals? Are they hybridizing animals that should not be put together with the eventual hope of re-releasing or having the ability to re-release these captive zoo animals out into the wild, but making sure they're as genetically similar to the wild populations as possible so that you have the best chance.
Wow.
But the lab I worked for was pretty amazing. I mean, we worked on everything from penguins to lions to, I mean, you pick it. And it was more of a service lab, so all the zoos from around the country could send in samples for free. We did a lot of bird sexing for people because there's a lot of species of birds where you really can't tell the difference between the males and the females. It's very difficult, but DNA has all the information, so you can go in there and do that. But yeah, and that's sort of given me a good background to understand sort of, how to use it in, domestic breeding and essentially prevent the same issues.
Which so we will we'll transfer to talking about that now, but I also the one other question that brought up for me is that people are frequently asking me what coefficient of inbreeding percentage to aim for in their breeding population, and I'm like, well, there's not like a hard line where it's good and it's bad, but what I tend to tell people is that the zoo people seem to aim for 10%, and so I'm like, that seems like a number to aim for. Do you have any insights on that?
Well, depending on where we looked, for wild populations, we tended to see somewhere between 10 to 20%, just depending
Usually as
on,
high as 20% in wild
it
pockets,
could be, yeah, depending on
small
the
ones.
condition we're looking at. And this also goes back to, we obviously didn't know who was or was not related to each other because these were just researchers out in the field.
Right.
Whatever penguin wa wandered by, they took a sample. Zoos tended to have a slightly higher coefficient of inbreeding. It tended to be probably in the, it could be as low as 15, but it tended to get up into the 20s or 30s percent. So, and it's a bit of a gray area. I mean, there is no magic number. Obviously, if you get up to 50%, you're dealing with much more related animals. But once you get down into about, 10 to 20%, it's there's some flexibility there. We deal with those same type of questions all the time, where people want a black and white answer. And unfortunately, through my experience over the last 25 years, there's very little black and white in biology. Lots of it tends to be gray.
And
So,
very dependent on the situation and the circumstances.
exactly. Yeah. So, it's a guide, but I wouldn't try to aim for a certain number. Again, 50% would probably be a little too high,
That
but
would be bad, yeah.
yeah, but I 10 to 20% is probably, a pretty comfortable range.
So then you got into DNA testing of dogs, genetic testing of dogs. How'd that happen?
Yeah, that was an interesting we so we got an Australian cattle dog puppy that we were sort of unaware at that time of genetic testing in dogs, and it wasn't new, but it was not as prevalent as it is now. And he ended up having PRA, PRCD, which essentially the dog goes blind by typically around the age of 8, somewhere in there, 8 to 10 maybe. And we found out that essentially he wasn't tested because of the cost. At that time, prices were probably anywhere from $100 to $150 for a single test. You got a litter of 5 or 6 dogs, and that gets expensive very quickly. So knowing I'd already been doing DNA work for a long time, and knowing what I knew about the cost, we just saw it as an opportunity to make a change, because it was silly to have dogs inflicted with genetic disease because the cost was too high. So we jumped in, and I'd say within a year or two, we started offering tests anywhere from $20 to $40. And we watched the whole industry change after that. So a lot of those $150 tests disappeared. The price came down. It became more available for people. It used to have to be a blood sample. We started using cheek swabs and just easier ways that people could just do it right in their home. So now you don't have the added cost of a veterinarian. And according to what we've seen, it's just made testing so accessible to people. So they now had the information they needed to make better decisions. And really our mission from the very first day was just not to have more dogs like Dexter. He was our Australian cattle dog. He's since passed, but he was really the inspiration for this. We were originally going to breed him, but once we had the information and knew it was happening, we decided not to, just based on our own personal choice. And that sort of just opened the door for us to start doing this. And it's been, I don't know, 12 years later, something like that. And yeah, it's worked out well.
Yeah, the industry's definitely changed in the 12 years. So can you talk about the technology a little bit? I know that when you and I were talking before, I was trying to figure out how you could offer the test so inexpensively compared to, so the, I think the testing company that most people are familiar with would be Embark. And not to, I don't want to be doing sort of the pros and cons too much, right? Because that's awkward. But
Yeah.
maybe you could talk a little bit about how your technology differs from their technology so people can understand that it's like how it's a different thing that you're doing.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Well, what we do, so every test that we offer, every test is individual. So, and we used to actually, we just introduced what we called breed-specific panels. I think we're almost 2 years in now. But prior to that, if you wanted to test a dog for, let's say, 3 or 4 different mutations, you had to swab the dog 3 or 4 times because every single swab and test was individual. We since have enhanced that, so now we are able to test any number of tests on a single swab, but every test that we do is an individual reaction, separate from each other. The difference for other companies, they use a technology called microarrays, which can test for many, many, many things. So when I say many, we're talking hundreds of thousands of mutations. And it's a good platform for that. The difference is there's a base cost to doing that type of testing because it's somewhat technologically complex. It requires a lot of processing. It's not something you can do in a few hours or even a day. It usually typically takes a couple days to go through the process. But again, it generates a lot of information. And it actually started out more as a research-based tool, for screening and looking for essentially common mutations among different populations. But we've always been an individual test company, and our costs for doing a single reaction is much lower than, setting up something that looks at, hundreds of thousands of different changes. And we just saw that as a common sense way to do it, because most dogs, pretty much, maybe three, four, five mutations at the most, right now are known in most breeds. It can go higher than that, in other breeds, but for the most part, you're looking at a handful of tests. So for us, it didn't really make sense to essentially generate all this information that really didn't contribute to making a decision, because that was really sort of our guiding principle. Was we wanted to provide people with the information they needed, nothing more, nothing less, to go ahead and make mostly breeding decisions, but also healthcare decisions where they didn't have to get, a 300-page report that, they only needed one page out of that report for the information. So, which that also, obviously increases the cost a little too. So we just saw it as sort of a common sense way to do it. And we've continued that way. Also, the other thing that helps us do it inexpensively is most of our process is automated. So we don't require a ton of people to do the testing. And people tend to be the most expensive part of a business. Our stuff is done mostly by robots and software. And most of the human intervention comes at the beginning and the end of the process where you've got to actually, cut the swab into a tube. But after that, most of it's automated. And then you need a person at the end for the, actual oversight and grading of the test. But pretty much everything in between is done by a robot.
I love that.
Yeah, and
Like,
robots don't need vacation. They don't ask for pay raises.
do
They
it
all you got
overnight.
to do is maintain them. That's all they need.
When I was in grad school, a lot of what I was doing was running these kinds of individual tests looking for particular markers. And obviously we didn't it was there's no point in automating what I was doing, right? Because I was doing a PhD, and so it was we were
Yes.
it was gonna be this, oh, this different thing this week, and then this different thing this week. But I just love the idea of having robots doing it instead of grad students doing it.
Well, an academic, I've worked in both academics and industry, and people cost a lot more in industry than they do in academics. Because, like you said, you've got lots of grad students, you've got people that you don't have to pay a lot of money. And that's really for academics, it's the reagents and consumables. That's their bigger cost, whereas in industry, it's really people. And that's actually how we started out. We did start out, and every reaction was set up by a person in the beginning. Robot, even just liquid handling robots, that technology has come a long way in the last couple of years. The price is significantly reduced as they figured out how to make those robots less expensive. So you're actually starting to see them more in academic labs now, for more of the routine processes that they do.
So are they like pipetting for you and things like
They
that?
are, yeah. They well,
Wow.
yeah. We started out with a fairly complex robot that was pretty expensive back in the day. And really, all it is essentially the equivalent of pipettes that get moved around, and you have a deck where you can set up all your plates and your reagents, and you just tell the robot where to go and what to pipette, and it gets it right every single time. There was a company that I think within the last probably 5 years, something like that, they figured out how to take essentially the equivalent of a 3D printer and mount some pipettes on it, which brought the cost of doing, robotic liquid handling way down.
So you're like printing with the liquid instead of printing with resin or.
Not printing, think of taking away the printer part of it and just adding a pipette to it. So you have the equivalent of like an XY gantry where it can move around in space. Well, actually an XYZ gantry because it's got to go up and down too. But replace the printer part with a pipette. And not a pipette like you're thinking of. These are specially made to fit the robot and
Sure.
electronically controlled. And essentially you feed it all the information that says go to this position. Go down to this spot, take up this much liquid, go over here, put it over here. The same exact thing a person does, but the robot does it all for you.
No one's going to appreciate this because they didn't spend the hours that I did. Like, so basically you have like all these, it's tiny, and you have the pipette, and you're constantly like pipette this tiny bit of liquid from here to here, and you're like someone would come up and ask me a question, and then I'd have lost my
Where was
place.
I?
Right. So you'd have to have the rule, like you don't talk to Heckman while she's doing this. And I remember that like the height of technology was the multi-pipette. So
Oh,
instead of having
multi-channels.
the single, I know you know what I'm talking about. So
Yeah,
instead
you
of
can do
having the single,
eight
so I've
instead of
made this
one.
is like a tiny, tiny turkey baster. So
Yeah.
instead of having the tiny, single, tiny turkey baster, you have five of them all lined up so that you can suck up five things and then put it,
Yep.
but then you have to have five things in a row that you have to put the same thing into, right? So,
Exactly. Yeah.
oh my God. But that was like when I could get it to do that, when I could set things up so that I could use the multi-pipette, which was pretty rare. It was a good week.
Well, and that's the other. So we moved to it for that reason because it cut costs, and then obviously, but really another really important reason why we moved to it was the potential for human error.
For
Because
sure.
like you just said, when you have a person setting these reactions up, a person can get distracted. A person can lose their place as to where they're at. Robots don't lose their place. They follow exactly what you tell them to do. So that was also one of the ways, because we're obviously constantly trying to improve our processes. No matter how good it gets, it can always be better. So that was one of our ways of eliminating part of the human error in the process, was taking the person out of the pipetting. So now everything's, right 100% of the time.
Do you have statistics for how often there are any errors in the results that you return?
That's actually a complex question.
Sure, yes, I get
Yeah,
that.
let me break that open a
Feel
little.
free to not answer yes or no, but to
Yeah.
hold forth for a while.
So, yes, we do track things. We track everything we do, because that allows us to identify patterns and know when something's not working right. But I think the question you're getting at is accuracy.
Yeah, well, so there's two ways of asking about accuracy, right? And one is whether you use linkage tests, which we should talk about because you don't do that. We should talk about that. But that is getting the correct marker, but there being something happening in the biology that we can't predict, right? Versus how often does it happen that you think you have something, but like if you were to redo the test, you'd get something
You get a
different
different
because there was
result.
some mistake. Like, does that, where would that happen in this process?
So we it's difficult to measure accuracy unless you have control of the entire process from beginning to end. And part of the issue with determining accuracy when you're using sort of these at-home kits where people are taking, where customers, individuals are taking the samples and sending them back to the laboratory, we have no control over that part of the process. We try to help people as much as possible to stay organized, but if you've got a litter of five dogs, eight dogs, 10 dogs, and things happen, mistakes happen where, the wrong swab might end up in the wrong dog's mouth or, any number of things. We can only be accurate for the swab that was put in a particular dog's
Fair.
mouth. That's the only thing we can guarantee, but we can't guarantee, what SWAT
Yeah,
dog
I've
moves through.
experienced this. When I was working at Darwin's Ark, we hated it when we would get, because we were always testing adult dogs, basically. But if there were two dogs who lived in the same house and we get the tests in at the same time, we were always like, oh God, this is. And so we started not letting people do that. We started only sending out one kit at a time and saying you can only test one dog at a time because it was
And
quite
even then,
bad so often.
it's probably not going to be 100%
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
like I said before, people make mistakes. So not being able to control that part of the process, we do look at as far as our accuracy for everything following that. Which the only real place, like I said, once we replace people with robots, human error is pretty much, been reduced. I can't say zero because there are still people involved in the process, but significantly reduced. The only thing that we can see occasionally, and the fancy term for it's called allelic dropout, which people in forensics are familiar with. But what can happen is we use a process called PCR, which is essentially a Xeroxing. It's a reaction where we can essentially make copies of a certain part of the DNA, so that we can look at that mutation and determine how many copies of it are present. Well, there's one case, if you have enough quantity and quality of DNA, because both of those factor into the result, you'll get the same answer every single time. So we could run the same sample 100 times, and if we have enough, if the quality and quantity of DNA is good enough, we get the same result every time. The problem is there is an amount, a quantity, and a quality of DNA where it's a little bit of a gray area where if there's not enough there or the quality is not good enough, what can happen is, and this only happens if the dog is a heterozygote, so it's got one clear copy and one copy with the mutation, the reaction that does the copying, because there's too little DNA there, could possibly start making copies of only one or the other. And what that means is a heterozygote could end up looking like a homozygote. And you could run that sample multiple times, and what you'll end up seeing is all three potential results. Because occasionally you will get a heterozygote, on another try, you'll get a clear, on another time you'll get an affected. So what we do over time, and this is specific to each test. There's no line you can draw across all tests, because again, we're performing individual reactions. So within each test, we can look at it and say, we've gotten a pretty good, over time, we've been able to draw lines to say if it's below this quantity and quality of DNA, we'll still get a result, but we don't trust it. So in our process, we essentially will repeat that reaction again to see what the result is. And if we still don't get something that falls within our quality control, where it essentially says that we can trust the result, we'll simply send out a new swab at no cost to people. Because we are a science-based company. Everything that we do is based in science, built on diagnostics. So if we don't trust the result, we don't report it. But again, this is biology. Like I said, this is one of those gray areas where, if you have a small enough amount or the quality is not good enough, you can get a false result. But over time, that's a rate, the better you define those limits and where those can happen. And this is pretty much happens in almost any type of biological test you can do. There tends to be these gray areas. And once you know where it is, then you know to avoid, making calls in those areas. So, and we've been doing this long enough that we know exactly where all those areas are for all of these tests.
So why would someone be submitting a DNA sample with small quantity or poor quality? Would it be like they just had trouble swabbing the dog, maybe, or?
Yeah, there's some confusion. Some people will swab teeth and gums. People think they're collecting saliva. It's just the process of taking the sample is just they're not going for the right thing. So we do try to help people by providing videos and directions, and but ultimately, if it's and it's and it's got a lot of wiggle room. I mean, again, we're collecting cheek cells. So the point of, what we try to do with people is try to get them to essentially rub the swab against the inside of the dog's cheek. But like I said, we can't control who's taking that sample, so sometimes that doesn't happen correctly. And what we've seen most of the time is most people that progress to the point where we have to send them a new swab, usually we're on the phone with them. We remind them that there's a video to watch, just sort of make sure that you're doing this in the right way. We'll also make suggestions like obviously don't swab your dog right after they eat. We do have recommendations in there, which again, we rely on people to follow these directions. But if you swab a dog right after they eat, there's things in food that can come through that can sort of reduce the quality of the reaction. So you're not getting the best reaction you can. We also tell people that, if you want to wait until the morning, that gives the dog's cheek cells time overnight to grow, so that essentially you're getting the best sample you can. For the most part, people don't tend to have problems with this, but that's why we could get a substandard sample, is just because it's just not taken in the correct way.
That makes sense.
It's been one of our stumbling blocks for years, but we've gradually improved things. So we've sort of been able to get results on less DNA, lower quality. So we've improved our side of things to accommodate it, but if you just shove a swab on a dog's tongue in and out, take it back out, then we're not going to get a good result on that.
No, for sure. It seems like you probably don't need a whole lot of DNA though to do what you're doing, so
No, we're
very
probably
little.
easy. Yeah, I mean, probably I'm guessing a couple hundred copies or something of that,
Yeah.
a couple hundred cells, and we can get a result. So,
Yeah.
but again, if something gets in there, dirt, food, anything,
Sure.
can also cause a problem too, because it sort of doesn't work well with the chemistry.
When I worked at the lab that did Darwin's Ark, we had someone send us poop once in our saliva sample.
Oh, yes.
The saliva tube. There was no saliva in it, but in the tube they sent us.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had taken us a
Switch
while
tubes,
to
isn't
get
it?
to opening that package, and we couldn't figure out why the room smelled so bad. And then at some point we figured it out.
We've actually joked around because occasionally we will get swabs in where it looks kind of like that, and we'll joke about what end they actually put the swab in.
Yeah,
That's
you
our
never know
process.
how the instructions are interpreted.
You never know, and you don't know what people are doing. But yeah, our process will not work on poop, and
Yeah.
if you put it in the wrong end, it will not work. I could tell you that for sure.
All right, so then the other way that things can go wrong, as we talked about, is linkage. Do you want to explain maybe what a linkage test is and
Yeah, sure. And this question actually relates back to the technology or platform that is being used for testing. So we can test for any type. So the way we test, we can test for any type of mutation, and there are a number of different kinds, from a single base change to a single base pair is deleted or added, to a couple of base pairs are deleted or added, or whole giant sections of sequence can be knocked out. We can do any of that and get a result on it directly for the mutation itself. There are other platforms that are limited in the types of mutations they can test for. So what happens is to accommodate that, and this really is referring to those microarrays that we were talking about, to accommodate their inability to test directly for the mutation that researchers have found and connected to a disease, they will look for a mutation that fits their platform that is right close by to the mutation that's known to cause the disease or phenotype. And most of the time, it's going to be correct, because what happens is those mutations tend to travel together. However, it's never going to be 100% because of the process that generates sperm cells and egg cells. There's a unique thing called recombination that happens in that process. It's why no siblings look exactly the same. And what happens is if that recombination event, which means certain parts of DNA are exchanged while those sperm and egg cells are being made, it can break that connection between the close by mutation and the mutation that's causing the issue. And what that's going to result in typically is a false positive, which you're going to detect that nearby mutation, but it no longer is connected to the one that causes disease, and you're going to give a false result based on that.
Could be a false negative as likely, or am I missing something there?
You could be. Yeah, it could go either way. But it's essentially something that they've got to worry about. And some companies that offer that type of testing are somewhat upfront about it. We don't offer any indirect testing. Every test we offer is direct, which means we only test for the mutation that is known to cause the issue. But again, to accommodate the use of those other platforms, you have to do indirect testing on certain mutations. Lots of mutations they can test for directly. And that's what we always tell customers, because that is some of the times we will get customers calling about a discrepant result that, you know, they got a result from us, they tested with one of these other companies, and the result doesn't match. We know some of the tests that's the answer. So people familiar with things like IVDD is one of those that
that because it's a large insertion, right?
Yep. Most of the large insertion deletions that tend to be tested for indirectly.
Right.
Just because their platforms can't handle that. So, but again, being a science-based company, we didn't feel comfortable. You know, essentially, we don't offer a test unless there's some good science behind it. So when we pick a test to offer, you know, now that we've developed our chemistry and our, you know, the way we do things, we've developed it to pretty much we can test for anything. But when we first started out, we had to learn how to adapt our chemistry to detect certain mutations. So we didn't offer those until we were able to do direct testing. And we pick tests based on the quality of the research that's done. So we'll look at the original research because, like I said, that's the first place the gray area in biology comes, is connecting mutations to disease. So what's the actual association between if you have that mutation, do you get the disease? Some diseases are like that, where they're black and white, or if you get the mutation, you know, there's not a dog known not to suffer from the disease. But unfortunately, that's usually not going to be the rule. Most of the time, a lot of tests are more risk-based because they're still understanding, you know, the connection. You know, it might not be the final mutation. It might not be the whole story. There might be multiple mutations involved because biology can be somewhat complex. So we sort of look at the quality of the research that's done, because that's where all these mutations typically come from, is researchers that are studying diseases in dogs and most of the time connecting them to diseases in humans, because dogs are a great model,
a great medical model.
Yeah. And especially since the publication of the dog genome and but we rely on that as a resource, and we determine, because there are some tests that we get requests for all the time where we just don't feel the science is there yet. That they're poking around, they found something, but it's not necessarily what we would think of as solid enough to drive people's decision.
Yeah, I think the word I would probably use is predictive, right? And
yeah,
so all the...
Yep.
Right. So, and all the different things we've been talking about here is how predictive a test is. So a linkage test, you know, we know exactly what's going on, but we also know that it's only going to be predictive 98% of the time or 97%
yes.
of the time or whatever. And that 3% can certainly be concerning when we're testing hundreds
yes.
or thousands.
And that's something that you can fit. That's one that's not biological. That's, again, that's related to the testing methods.
Right.
So that's controllable.
It's controllable depending on your technology. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And then there's how predictive the test is based on, you know, I think what happens with a lot of testing companies, I know you and I have talked about this, is that the publication comes out and the researcher has found, well, when we did our Darwin's Ark publication, we found a region that was strongly associated with the likelihood of the dog being very human sociable. And I could very much see breeders wanting to be able to test to say, is this, you know, is this dog carry this allele for being very human sociable? You know, that'd be a great thing to breed for. But I wouldn't recommend that anyone make a test on that because we had just found this region and we just didn't really know what was going on there. So it was, you know, while it was good science, it was not very predictive for, you know, good for making a predictive test from. And there is, of course, the influence of an environment as well, right? So we were talking about IVDD, which is a great example of a test where you 100% know the dog has the mutation, which has changed the dog's phenotype for sure.
Yep.
But don't know if it's actually going to herniate, as that's only part of the phenotype.
And that tends to be the story for a lot of mutations we test for. And again, I think you were touching on, too, that it's the maturity of the research too, because the scientific process, whatever people, you know, as quick as they want it to move, science moves very slowly.
Yes, it does.
So that's the starting point is, like you were saying, if you find a mutation or a set of mutations that's connected to something like behavior, you know, or let's say height in human beings or anything that probably has more than just one thing, that's a complex story to unravel. So usually it's not the first publication. That's the one that gets things started. It points people in a direction and says, we think we found something here. This deserves more research, more attention, more thought, which is also how we gauge things too. We look at, you know, is there follow-up work that's been done? You know, has another publication either supported, you know, the original findings, or does it contradict? Because we see that too, you know, depending on what dog population you're looking at, North American versus European, you can see different results where, you know, a North American population might see a significant correlation between the mutation and disease. Whereas if you look in a different population, you don't get the same result. So it's, like I said earlier on, it's just not very little of this is black and white. But the other source besides research that we rely on are breed health committees. So those are the folks that track this stuff. They know the inside and out of that breed, you know, and what's going on and how many dogs are showing symptoms. So essentially we rely on them also, because sometimes we'll look at the research and it might not be that strong. But the health committee people believe that it's something that can help guide better decisions in their breed. So we use them as a resource as well to sort of weigh both those sides and say, well, is this something that we should be offering or not? So we are pretty selective about, you know, what we do add to our menu or what we don't, because, you know, we're not here to just offer tests for, you know, to take people's money. That's not the point of this. I mean, we're business. We do have to, you know, keep the lights on and pay the bills. But at the end of the day, really our guiding mission is just improving dog health and by helping empowering people with the information they need to do that. And technology's come far enough now that it's great. I mean, to be able to do this, to be able to swab your dog's cheek and, you know, within a couple of days have some information about, you know, things that you can control, or, you know, we have a lot of pet parents that test for health. Which we haven't even touched on that part of it, which is, you know, this helps guide certain decisions. You know, some of it could be diet. There's mutations we test for that, you know, it's an enzyme in some kind of metabolic pathway that's been knocked out. And, you know, if you simply avoid certain fats, or if you, you know, look at copper levels, or, you know, if you just simply keep that out of your dog's diet, even though they have the mutation, it doesn't cause any problems. Versus some of the stuff we test for where, you know, there really is nothing you can do. And some of it's going to come later in life, like Dexter's, you know, PRCD, where he was going blind. But just knowing that was coming and knowing what was in store for us, it allowed us to make different decisions for him. And then we knew how to accommodate him when it set in. You know, things like, okay, we know what's happening. We can, you know, build ramps downstairs and help him, you know, gauge the inside of the house and know where he is, and just all of that. It just helps, you know, pet parents and vets make better decisions about how to care for these pets too as they age.
I have a friend whose dog was diagnosed with PRA. I assume she did a genetic test to confirm that. She got a second dog to act as a guide dog, apparently.
Yeah.
Have you heard of this? Apparently, particularly if you get them before the dog has fully gone blind, they learn to sort of follow. They can sort of hear or feel where the other dog is and can follow them around.
Yeah, we heard of that one. The other trick people use is you can take different set, like if you want to help the dog understand where they are, like let's say, inside the house, you can take different scents and put them on different doorways.
I have not heard of that. That is
Yeah.
interesting.
So they get basically a map of the house with their nose, which they probably
That's
have
good.
anyway, because I'm guessing different rooms probably smell slightly differently anyway, but you could
Yeah,
take
yeah.
like different essential oils or something.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I was just talking with a friend yesterday who she's fostering a blind dog, and she said she finally figured out that the dog will walk up to the couch and stand staring with its face up against the couch. And she realized that the dog couldn't differentiate between the couch and the door. And the dog was basically like, I'm at an obstacle. I think it's the door. I need to go out to pee. And so
Yeah.
standing up against a wall or the couch meant I need to go out to pee. She's like, once I figured that out, we were fine.
Yeah, it's all about communication. And
Yes.
animals know how to communicate if you watch. If
Yes.
you learn how to communicate with them, they'll tell you
They will for sure.
what they need. But yeah, it's we found just the information is power, regardless of whether you're breeding, caring for an animal, even veterinarians when they're trying to diagnose stuff. We've had friends that unfortunately their dog had degenerative myelopathy, but they would go through unfortunately go through tons of unneeded testing, MRIs and all, because you're looking for trauma, you're looking for something, you're looking in the wrong place. And we, had to tell them, well, for 30, $40, why don't you just do this test real fast? And unfortunately, that's, what it ended up being. But it's also a great tool to sort of a good starting place to say, well, if the dog, tests affected for, let's say, DM, then all that other expensive testing probably is not necessary because you probably have your answer, depending on what the breed is.
Debating whether to dig down into that with you, because the story that I had heard about DM was that it is still worth doing some of the other testing, given that the DM test is not a 100% one.
Yeah,
You
that's
still might want to do some of the other testing because it doesn't mean that it necessarily is DM, just because
yes,
it's very indicative, right? They can have the signs.
yep.
And then if they're positive genetically, it's very indicative. But I think the story that I heard was someone who said that the dog had some neurologic signs and the genetic test came back positive for DM, and the owner chose to euthanize rather than do more testing or go forward. And there was sort of anxiety about whether, perhaps they had put too much confidence in that test.
That's where I caveat with depending on the breed. So DM, unfortunately, again, another complex disease. We're not quite black and white, but certain breeds, Corgis, German Shepherds, Bernese Mountain Dogs, there's a couple of them where unfortunately those dogs, when they test affected, a large percentage of the time they do, assuming they live long enough, because again, this is a later stage disease. I mean, some dogs might not show symptoms till they're 10 or even 12. And obviously, if a dog doesn't live that long, they can test affected and not have a problem. Because, I mean, the issue with DM is essentially you're getting a mutation in a protein. It's the SOD1 gene, which is an enzyme involved with cleaning stuff out of your system. But when the mutation's present, the protein essentially doesn't fold correctly and becomes insoluble. And it becomes insoluble in the spinal cord. So, unfortunately, over time, as more of that insoluble protein builds up, it eventually starts blocking nerve signals. You'll start to see it, hind leg dragging, and then, it kind of goes from there. But that can also have a lot to do with environment, depending on diet and all kinds of other stuff. Those
Exercise,
insoluble
yeah.
proteins could accumulate, not as quickly. So, but certain breeds, it tends to be a fairly good diagnostic. In other breeds, I'd say don't even pay attention to the result because there are other breeds that unfortunately have the mutation. Well, not unfortunately, fortunately for the breed, they have the mutation, but none of the dogs in the breed ever seem to come down with the disease, which
Yeah,
again,
that's
it's all
fair. And the dog, this
complex.
story I heard about was a mixed breed dog.
Yeah, which depending on what breeds were in there, I'd say, yeah, it's not a good diagnostic for that. But if you've got a German Shepherd that's dragging a leg and tests as affected for DM, you could still go down the road of doing those other diagnostics, but I would say it's a really good chance that that's what it is. And unfortunately for DM, the only way to truly diagnose it is post-mortem. You have to take a section and stain. I mean, that really is the only way to get your definitive answer.
Which brings us to one of the topics you and I were talking about previously of your interest in being able to figure out which of these tests are applicable to sort of a variety of breeds when they've only been actually verified in certain breeds. And do you have plans for trying to collect that kind of data?
We're trying, yeah, we're
You're trying.
we've been thinking about, well, you and I have talked about it. We've been thinking about this for a while. And it really is just, when the opportunity presents itself. And there's stuff out there like OFA in certain databases where they are starting to try and track this kind of information. Because there's two things going on. The first thing is getting a better understanding above the original research, because wherever they find the research that finds these mutations tends to use a very limited number of dogs, a limited number of breeds, so you're getting a picture, but it's kind of fuzzy. So to get a really good idea, what you really need to do is increase your N number. You need to have more dogs, follow them throughout their lifetime, and get a better understanding of does this mutation actually lead, how often does the mutation actually lead to the disease? And you could do that across multiple breeds, but it would take tracking all that information across a dog's lifetime. So that's one thing. The other thing too, which this comes more out of that, those microarrays and sort of testing for all these tests in every breed, and not all mutations, but lots of mutations end up being found in other breeds, because when you send, no matter what dog you send in for that type of testing, they are testing every mutation on their menu is getting tested for every dog. They're going to see
That's just
those.
how the technology works.
That's how it works, and it's one of the benefits of it. It's one of the reasons people, researchers originally used it. But the problem is that can lead to confusion. A good example would be we get lots and lots of people asking about copper toxicosis. There was research done that essentially located mutations in Labrador retrievers that impact copper levels. And we started getting requests from all kinds of other breeds, and we let people test for whatever they want. We provide the information. We tell them, we make recommendations based on the research, what tests apply to what breeds, but we give people the freedom to test for whatever they want if they think it's important. And those mutations show up in a lot of other breeds. The problem is we can't definitively say what's going to happen to a non-Labrador retriever that has those mutations because there's no research to support it. And that harkens back to if you had a database where you could then track these other breeds over time, you could start to see is there a correlation there for that.
Yeah.
But it leads
Hopefully
to
you can find
confusion.
out. So the way it would work obviously would be that there would be something else in the Labrador genome that was interacting, right? And it would be ideal to find out what that something else was, so that when you're looking at a mixed breed, for example, do they have both the things. I actually had Dr. Hilla Featon on the podcast a few weeks back. She's the researcher who found the top I almost said topper toxicosis, copper toxicosis mutation. And I asked her exactly that question of, has it been tested in any other breeds? And there's one other breed besides Lab. I don't remember what it is off the top
Oh,
of my head.
don't, yeah, I think
Dobermans? Dobermans?
they've got one out of the two that
Okay.
seem to, I think there was one study where they saw a correlation for one of the mutations. The other one they
Yeah. But and she said they've looked at some other breeds and they haven't seen correlation in those other breeds, so we don't know which breeds are affected or which are not. So that's frustrating for a lot of people, I know.
It is. Well, because lots of dogs suffer from copper toxicosis. There's one other breed, what is it, the Bedlam Terrier. There is a separate mutation that causes their copper toxicosis. So It could be combinations of things where basically, you know, these are the mutations that cause it in Labrador retrievers, but there could be other mutations that cause it in Dalmatians or, you know, other breeds that suffer from the disease. And we don't just tell people to test just to get a result. Again, we take it to the next step, which is you need to be able to make a decision off the information we give you.
Right.
And if we can't give you information that's decision worthy, then we don't tend to offer it, or we don't recommend it. Like I said, we give.
One of the most frustrating things of being a vet student is when they ask you what test you would do, and you know all the tests that you could do, and you start rattling them off, and your attending is like, okay, and so what would you do with the information of that test? And as a vet student, you just want all the information, right? You're not really sure what you're going to do with it. And the question is always, well, would it change your decision-making tree if you had the result of that test? And that was one of the most powerful things I think I learned in vet school.
That's a very advanced, that's when you've been, you know, doing veterinary science for, you know, 10 years, you're thinking in that way, which is, I understand the big picture now. What is going to give me the information, like you said, to move forward with a better diagnosis, or, you know, essentially get a better picture of what's going on. So, but it's a balance. I mean, we've also seen, like I said, we rely on breeders to also their experience. I mean, they've been doing this for years and they see a lot of things that the researchers don't get to see, the, you know, some of the testing companies don't get to see. So occasionally we've had the opposite situation where a breed knows that that mutation is present in their breed and causes the disease, where it hasn't been reported in a scientific publication or anywhere else. And that's where we allow a little bit of flexibility to say, well, the research is not, you know, the end all be all that makes the decision, and neither is, you know, it's a grouping of all the information you have to say, well, you know, is this worth it? Is this going to, like you said, like a vet student, is this going to help me make a better decision or not? So, and we have seen that occasionally where breeders and, you know, breed health committees know, yep, that's a mutation in our breed, and yes, we know that dogs that, you know, are affected by that mutation get the disease. So, we sort of try and keep it flexible just to allow that too, you know, just be open-minded that, you know, there is no one catch-all answer to all of this. Because I know people like to think in black and white, and they like to put everything in
It's easy to do that,
categories.
and you don't like it. Yeah.
Yeah, it just, the reality is biology just doesn't work that way.
Unfortunately not. So given that there's a fair number of breeders who listen to this podcast, are you trying to make connections with breed clubs or breeders? Is there any message you would want to get out there? Like, are you trying to form relationships, anything like that?
Yeah, we do. We actively interact with breed clubs and, you know, approach them, you know, just sort of educating them on what this is and what our services are and what can be done. And actually, I think later today, I actually have a presentation to a breed club on DNA testing. But yeah, it's just really, it's we try to educate as much as possible. And we know that, you know, breeders are, you know, the biggest part of our customer base because they've known about genetics and mutations, and they've seen it for a long time. They know the value of this. We've had harder pet parents trying to get it too, especially with the information that's out there. Our toughest group is usually veterinarians.
Really, was that?
Well, from what we've been able to understand, it's not a lot of background. So in vet school, I
For
don't
sure.
think they cover it very much. And it's just not at the forefront of what they do and how they
Yeah.
think about things. So, you know, broken bones and you know, infectious disease and cuts and all that, that's the focus. And there are some vets that are understand the value of this, and not all these tests apply. You know, some of them do and can be used for, you know, like I was mentioning, DM could be used as a diagnostic in certain breeds. But yeah, that's one. It's been a lot easier to educate breeders because they know this. They've, you know, even if they don't know the genetics and they don't, you know, they know they've seen this. They know what it is. You know, like I was saying, my wife breeds dairy goats, and she will occasionally, you know, put two together and get something out that just, you know, has something wrong in, you know, the offspring. and one more breeding and you get the same result, and obviously it's genetic. And breeders know that. If you keep putting the same pair together and you keep getting, disease, very, very likely it's genetic. So, and they've known that for a long time, but now I think it's the power of the technology and the understanding to say, well, not only do we know there's a problem, but now we can zero in on what causes that problem. And then, obviously offering the testing to say, well, now you can avoid it and try and, not produce animals with disease, which, I think is in everybody's best interest.
It is for sure. So if people wanted to know more about Gensol or about you, where would they go?
Yeah, you can start on our website. It's just gensoldx.com. We have lots of information. We're adding more all the time. And just give us a call, email. We're always open to, helping people understand this. We have we always tell people to kind of run through our blogs. We try to cover as much information in there as possible. But yeah, start at our website, and if you don't see what you need to answer your question, just give us a ring.
Excellent. Well, Micah, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Perry. I really appreciate it, and I think you guys are doing a great thing too.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Hey, friends. Some of you have asked how to support the podcast, so we have set up a Patreon page for it. For a small monthly pledge, you help us pay for producing this podcast, and in exchange, you get a chance to suggest questions for podcast guests, and you get early access to podcast episodes. To find out more, go to patreon.com/functionalbreeding. You could also help promote the podcast through subscribing to it through the podcast app of your choice and by leaving favorable reviews. If you're interested in supporting the Functional Dog Collaborative more generally, or finding ways to get involved, go to the functionalbreeding.org website and click the support link. Thanks to everyone who has helped out. We could not do this without you. Thanks so much for listening. The Functional Breeding Podcast is a product of the Functional Dog Collaborative and was produced by Attila Martin. Come join us at the Functional Breeding Facebook group to talk about this episode or about responsible breeding practices in general. To learn more about the FDC, check out the functionalbreeding.org website. Enjoy your dogs.